Act 1, car sales. Act 2, the bond market. Act 3, banks still behaving badly. Three things that happened while people were paying attention to other stuff. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday it is, the 1st of August. Good as always to have you here, everybody. It has been distracting, shall we say, all the Washington-based hubbub, the comings and goings at the White House, the tweets, the whole smash. So today, news and or developments of an economic sort that might have escaped your notice in all the chaos. Starting in Detroit, we learned this morning that sales last month were down across the board for Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler, not by a little bit either. This makes seven straight months of declines for the American car industry writ large after a good couple of years, which is where Marketplace's Adam Allington starts us off.
Even the best parties have to end. When the keg is tapped and all the snacks are gone, it's time to call it a night. That's kind of the situation facing U.S. carmakers right now. After years of chart-topping sales, the industry is drifting back to earth. The question now is, how far will the fall be? Unlike years past, Paul Eisenstein of the DetroitBureau.com says carmakers are acting defensively.
Rather than trying to continue producing cars and then dump them on the market any way they can with low-rate loans or dumping them into daily rental fleets, they're preparing to cut production.
Eisenstein says GM has already cut six shifts since last fall, and Ford is considering an end to several models of low-selling sedans. It's almost like the last auto crisis is still fresh in everyone's mind.
The behaviors that we're seeing in the auto industry now reflects that.
Kristen Dietschik is with the Center for Automotive Research. While she doesn't think we're in for a repeat of 2008, carmakers today are in much better shape to deal with it.
The balance sheets are in much better shape now. They're much stronger companies to weather any storm.
Auto sales translate into about 3.5% of the economy. Stephanie Brindley is with IHS Market. She says while a slump in sales isn't good news for manufacturing jobs,
it doesn't necessarily mean that what we're seeing right now is indicative of a weakening in the economy.
Brindley says IHS sales forecasts for next year are predicting a slight rebound to around 17.2 million cars sold. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
With the caveat here that Alan Greenspan's prognosticatory talents haven't always been spot on, the former Fed chairman said something interesting today. Talking to Bloomberg, Greenspan said he thinks we're in a bond market bubble, and he's a bit worried. Inflation's going to surprise us, then bond prices could in the near-ish future fall sharply, which would send interest rates higher. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour takes a look at Greenspan's words of warning.
Right now, the returns on bonds are historically low, and investors are fine with that. The price of bonds is pretty high. Alan Greenspan is saying that investors are going to realize they should not be fine with that. They should not be fine with such low yields on bonds.
Alan Greenspan believes that the market is underestimating the future rate of inflation and perhaps the long-term outlook for the U.S. economy.
John Lonsky is managing director at Moody's Analytics. The idea is that growth and inflation might surge unexpectedly and eat into investments. And people holding bonds will say, OMG, we have made a terrible mistake. We bought bonds with low returns. Now inflation is ruining everything. Why did we do that?
The bond market bubble will burst.
Investors will get out of bonds. Bond prices will tank, and bond buyers will start demanding higher yields. That would be bad. Vincent Reinhardt is chief economist at Standish Mellon Asset Management.
Bond yields determine what households pay for fixed-rate mortgages. So households would be paying more if they wanted to get a new mortgage.
Crashing bond prices could drag down the stock market and raise government borrowing costs, too. But all of this rests on Greenspan's assumption that inflation is going to appear like Jaws from the deep.
I think he's wrong.
Again, John Lonsky with Moody's Analytics.
This thought of a possible bond market bubble has been around for quite some time.
He says we have a new economy, new demographics, new technology, and low inflation is here to stay for the time being. Who's right? Who's wrong? Pop that popcorn, because we'll all find out sometime. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Wells Fargo is once again and somehow still in hot water. The bank has admitted to charging customers for auto insurance they didn't want or need, following a report in the New York Times that more than 800,000 people who took out car loans had the insurance foisted on them. This is, of course, the same Wells Fargo which has admitted opening 2 million bogus accounts to meet inflated sales goals and is accused of changing mortgage terms without telling its customers. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the latest on Wells.
Wells Fargo says it will refund about 570,000 customers who were unwittingly charged for car insurance between 2012 and 2017. That'll cost about $80 million. A proposed class action lawsuit seeks additional damages, and Senator Elizabeth Warren is stepping up her pleas that the Federal Reserve oust most of Wells Fargo's board members. Stanford University banking expert Anat Admati also favors booting out the board.
Regulators actually have the power to remove the board because they can judge the board's monitoring work as allowing certain behaviors that are endangering the bank.
Fed Chair Janet Yellen hasn't ruled out such a move, though Admati admits it would be unusual.
I don't recall anything of this sort happen, except obviously when a bank fails entirely and it's in bankruptcy or some kind of a resolution process where everybody is out and you have new management.
Wells Fargo declined an interview, but in a statement pointed out that last year's scandal prompted, quote, many actions in response to its retail sales practices issues, including changes in senior leadership, unquote. Banking analyst Stephen Bigger with Argus Research thinks the Fed ousting board members is a long shot. He thinks fines are more likely, but he sees a more sweeping consequence.
The penalty is more in the reputational damage than the dollar damage.
He says after last year's scandal, not just individuals, but states and municipalities avoided Wells Fargo. And he says more of that may come. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh so close to Dow 22,000. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's something of a disconnect happening between what's known as the private market, what companies are worth before they go public, and what those companies are worth once they have their initial public offering, the public markets. Examples A and B today are the meal kit delivery service Blue Apron and whatever service you want to call Snap of Snapchat fame, which haven't been and whose share prices reflect that they have not been the sure bets a whole lot of investors had been hoping. Maureen Farrell chaired the byline in the Wall Street Journal on a story today about this valuation disconnect. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
One of the things that you say in this piece is that the number of unicorns, which are companies valued at a $1 billion or more in the private markets, is up some astounding figures. I mean, there's like a zillion of them out there now.
It's been a really incredible phenomenon. I mean, by Dow Jones Venture Count source, it's almost 170 companies valued at $1 billion or more. Before the financial crisis, there really hadn't been any billion-dollar private companies, because at that point, basically, you went to the public markets to get money. So the question in Silicon Valley and in other parts of the world is, why go through all the trouble of being a public company? And if you don't have to, if someone else is going to give me a really big check,
okay,
but if I can do what I want.
Right, totally. But if I'm a venture capitalist and I see all these companies going public and then their valuations cratering in a relative sense, I mean, $1 billion is still $1 billion, you know, for Blue Apron or whatever on the public markets. If I see those values going down, why am I going to keep plowing my money in the late stage of these companies being private?
That's a really, really good question. And I think it's a question very much on a lot of their minds right now. But SoftBank, the Japanese telecom company, they and the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund together have $100 billion. They just launched a fund to put into private tech companies.
Wow.
I mean, that's the largest ever fund totally dedicated to private tech companies. We're in this weird new world where there's so much private capital. SoftBank's Vision Fund has money they just have to put to work. So there's this real like push and pull on valuation and where things should stand.
Let me take you a little bit sideways. A story that broke this morning that I understand you're working on for tomorrow or later today at the Journal. This idea from the S&P, the S&P 500 index, that they are going to restrict now companies getting onto that index if they don't meet certain corporate governance guidelines. That is to say, who gets to vote, what the shares are like. Explain to me the dilemma there and what could conceivably happen.
So basically, it looks like they're proposing to limit, at the very least, like dual class shares, which, you know, Snap had a structure like this, Facebook, Google, in a case of where the founders essentially get to keep control and give the public a much more limited number of votes compared to the votes they have. So now the S&P 500 is going to limit going into their index if you have a structure like this. When Snap went public, even with its recent troubles, they went public when you got, if you bought a share of Snap in the IPO, you got zero votes. And that was a really somewhat unprecedented move. And they got basically negligible pushback from potential shareholders.
Yeah. I wonder if they feel differently now that Snap isn't doing so well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting what they would have to say about that right now.
Maureen Farrell, she covers IPOs for the Wall Street Journal, writing today with Corey Drybush. And more tomorrow, actually, on the S&P. Maureen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
We've been looking lately at what happens when communities lose jobs or economic ways of life that are hard to replace because they have become embedded in the local culture. Only a couple of generations ago, hunting put food on the table for a whole lot of families. It was an economic staple, really. But fewer of us are waking up before dawn, putting on camouflage and taking a rifle into the woods. So that is what we sent Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee, out to do.
An experienced turkey hunter looks a little like a sound effects artist. Leith Conondyke has a half dozen instruments in his camo pack meant to attract a big gobbler. One is a wooden paddle and what looks like a mini cigar box.
There's nothing special about it, but a lot of turkeys have died because of it.
Conondyke whispers as not to scare the turkeys away. He says he learned how to use all kinds of calls from watching his uncles.
You ever seen a diaphragm call? This one's brand new, untouched.
He sticks a piece of plastic in his bearded cheek. Conondyke makes his living in the Tennessee woods as a game warden. He's a mountain of a man with a studious appreciation for one of the oldest industries in America. There was a time when hunting wasn't about trophies, it was a necessity.
So it had a lot to do with our foundation of who we are today, and I think that's what we're trying to pass on.
There's been a slight uptick in the last couple of years, but Conondyke has seen the trend lines, a fairly steady decline in hunters since the 1970s. Fewer young people are taking up what is now primarily a leisure activity. And that's why he goes out of his way to promote hunting to teens, starting with his two sons. Today, he's just the guide and loading a shotgun for his 14-year-old named Lake, who's never bagged a turkey, though he already calls hunting an addiction. It's the adrenaline rush of having an animal in the sights.
I mean, your heart is pumping real fast while you're aiming, getting ready to shoot.
The Conondykes live in a fairly rural part of Tennessee where barns and fence rows still dominate the landscape. But Lake says most of his friends don't hunt. Some even turn their noses up at it.
I mean, you could talk to a girl about it and she's throwing up over there. I'm like, I'm talking about it. I'm not showing you a picture of a doe that I just gutted or showing you a video. I did that once for 4-H. It ended up terrible.
He field-dressed a dove in front of his class. The headwinds are straightforward, according to a report by the research firm Ibis World this year. As the country continues to urbanize, people lose touch with rural activities. They might not know anyone with land to hunt on. They might even think hunting sounds cruel. But Leith Conondyke also recognizes a strange phenomenon. Even as fewer of us hunt, census figures show hunters are spending more doing it.
So you got all this stuff and people are bombarded with, you know, what boots to wear and what camo to wear and what scent to use. And when I was a kid, man, I mean, I remember wearing multiple pairs of socks and, you know, you wore your boots when they started not fitting. You just took off a pair of socks, you know.
Leith has become a bit of a gear hog at this point, too. But he says he tries to steer beginners toward what he sees as character building benefits.
Part of, like, taking kids hunting is there's a reward to patience. They're coming to us.
Leith and his son Lake are squatting against trees about 20 feet apart. They're talking softly and trying to blend in as a big red-headed turkey follows a group of hens strutting through a swampy area. Leith gives the signal. The gobbler's in range. He aims and takes a shot. A few moments pass, and the father cheers on his son.
Woo!
Congratulations, man, on your first bird. Well, go get him. I can't even get up. My heart races.
The father and son take a photo together, posing with Lake's first kill. It's a portrait that this family will treasure. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They're coming from coding boot camps, community colleges.
New ways into high-tech jobs, but first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 72 points today, 0.3%, 21,963. NASDAQ up 14 points, 0.2%, 6,362. The S&P 500 up 6, 0.2%, 2,476. Lack of focus and waning consumer interest in the brand, just some of the reasons that analysts say are the cause of Under Armour's woes. The athletic retailer reported a disappointing second quarter and a restructuring plan that will trim its workforce by 2%. Thus, shares down 8.5% today. Nike up about 1.3%. Adidas down 0.6%. Sprint is eyeing a merger with rival carrier T-Mobile, as well as a tie-up with the cable provider Charter Communications. So on that news, Sprint up 11.1%. Today, bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The European Union has announced a new emergency relief package for Greece, $245 million, give or take, because while it has faded from the headlines, the European refugee crisis is still very real. There are more than 10,000 people stuck in Greek refugee camps waiting to hear whether they'll be allowed to stay in Europe or be deported. Migrants haven't always been warmly received in Europe, as you know, but the little-known Greek island of Tilos, population 800 or so, is putting out the welcome mat. It's taken in 45 Syrian refugees in the hopes of boosting its population and the local economy. The BBC's Gavin Lee has the story.
It's gone midnight, and the only business still running in the main town of Levadia is the Tilos bakery. Kusey Aldamad is the town's new baker, grafting away, making bread. He used to fit air conditioning units in the Syrian city of Daraa. When he fled with his family, his aim was Germany. He'd never heard of Tilos. None of the refugees had.
When I arrived here, I think all my life changed. I learning how to make bread, how to make sweet. I am very happy for help people here.
It's now 10 o'clock in the morning in the port of Levadia. The beachside bars and cafes are opening up. There are tourists swimming and sunbathing, some being served by the new Syrian bar assistant, Ahmed, on the terrace of Hotel Elena. Inside, two other Syrians are working as housekeepers. One of them is Maha Baraka.
Excuse me, clean room?
She spoke no English when she arrived in February. After intense English and Greek lessons, she is now almost fluent.
My husband, Abdelrahman, has now a name, King Falafel.
They call him the King of Falafel.
Yes, and I hope for him has a restaurant here, and the name restaurant King Falafel.
So you might set up the first Syrian Greek restaurant here on Tilos.
Yes.
And call it the King Falafel.
Yes.
Restaurant. That's your dream.
Yes, this is my dream.
You did number 44.
Mihalis Kyprios, her new boss and the hotel's owner, is watching on. He says the idea to embrace refugees is typically Tilian. It's a place where things have often been done differently.
There were people here who had always open minds. So the thing here is that we sit down and we start thinking how we can solve all these problems.
A group of tourists arrive, guided by Andreas Ladopoulos.
No, one moment.
He doesn't want to talk to me outside, but inside his hotel, he says he's worried about what's happening on the island.
We are friendly with them. We want them. Why not? They're people. They're human beings. But we are just 800, we can say on the papers, okay. So you will realize that one day we'll become a small Syria town.
So it's about, for you, it's the preservation of cultural identity.
Yes.
On our left is the school.
Back at the refugee centre, Faye Kudzuku from the Greek charity Solidarity Now, which is orchestrating the refugee project, says the numbers will stay at 50 for now, while refugees settle and continue to integrate.
At the moment, we're almost full capacity. And because all these people have been, most of them have been recognized, so they have received their positive asylum decision here in Greece.
But I guess there's a difference, isn't there, between 50 people here and several thousand on Lesbos and Chios and the other islands?
Yes, but Tilos is a small society. There are so many other societies like Tilos. This could be replicated in a village in Peloponnese.
The reality for most migrants and refugees on other islands is a far cry from the situation here. Most find themselves in basic camps, destined to return to Turkey to seek asylum from there as part of the EU's migration plan. But aid workers stay hopeful that the Tilos project could work elsewhere.
The BBC's Gavin Lee on the Greek island of Tilos for us. The technology industry has a whole lot of jobs to fill, so at IBM, they are changing where they look for people to fill those jobs. The idea is to hire more people who don't have four-year college degrees. Sam Latta is a VP for Human Resources at IBM. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Who are the people who are applying for these new-collar jobs, I guess is the buzzword?
Well, we see people coming through new pathways to IT. In fact, about 15% of the people we hire each year in the U.S. don't have a bachelor's degree. They're coming from coding boot camps, community colleges, and there's also the new approach to high school called P-TECH.
Is it a supply-demand thing? Are you just not finding college graduates to do these jobs, or the jobs themselves require a different thing than you learn in college, possibly?
Well, it's a little bit of both. About 500,000 technology jobs go unfilled in the U.S., and it's because employers can't find what they're looking for. Now, the country is only producing about 50,000 computer science grads each year. That's the skills gap. 500,000 unfilled jobs is definitely about supply-demand. The other dynamic is the industry has changed. So we're looking for people who understand things like cognitive computing, understand cloud, and cybersecurity has become more and more important over the years.
The trend you are seeing now in these new-collar jobs and the requirements that IBM has, does it decrease the need for a four-year college degree in this economy?
Well, I don't think that will happen, Kai. I think we're going to continue to have a need for people with four-year degrees, with master's degrees and PhDs. We're saying that if we're going to address the skills gap, we've got to think differently about where we're recruiting and who we're recruiting.
Well, to that end, actually, and this is a little trickier question. Actually, the question's fine. The answer is going to be trickier for you. Mostly white guys getting these jobs? How do you address that part of what everybody in tech acknowledges is a problem?
No, not at all. I would say it's been a very diverse group of people that we've recruited into new collar jobs. In fact, based on the locations that we put many of these jobs, it allows us to tap into markets that we ordinarily wouldn't be in. Places like West Virginia, Louisiana, Missouri, Iowa, and Michigan. We have thousands of IBMers working in technology centers across those states, which is what New Collar is all about.
When did you know, and this is the larger IBM question, and I will say here we've invited Ginny Rometty on many times. When did you know that this was going to be sort of a big chunk of your workforce of the future?
Well, we've been recruiting a pretty significant percentage of the workforce to IBM without traditional four-year degrees for quite some time. The trend that we identified and named was very specifically in November of last year. And Ginny Rometty wrote an open letter saying that we can partner with the current government on creating jobs in the U.S. to address this skills gap by doing many of the things that I described here.
So that brings up actually an interesting question, which is, are you getting the support, the political support for this new trend that you have spotted?
First of all, there are things that we need to do in the private sector. We need to shift the mindset on whether a four-year degree is really required. There are also things that we can do in the public sector. So we're looking forward to seeing the funding for vocational and technical training being reauthorized. And we're also looking forward to seeing the federal degree work study program modernized so it allows students to work in companies like IBM at sites that are very close to their campus.
Sam, thanks a lot.
Great to be here, Kai. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, you are going to think I'm making this up, but I'm not. Honest, I'm not. You remember how during the transition, then-President-elect Trump complained about the anticipated cost of replacing Air Force One and its backup, and he famously called the CEO of Boeing about it? Well, today from the industry newsletter Defense One, the rest of the story. The United States Air Force has indeed found a cheaper way to replace the president's planes. It's buying a pair of used Boeing 747s that were originally ordered up by a now bankrupt Russian airline and have been sitting abandoned in an airplane boneyard in the Mojave Desert since February. An Air Force spokesman said they expect to sign a contract, quote, soon. Sticker price not disclosed. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 72 today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ up 14, 0.2%. S&P 500 up 6, 0.2%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.